South Africa is often cited as one of the most stable countries in Africa, but it's been grappling with rampant government corruption for many years. Unemployment has gone as high as 23%, and there's staggering income inequality. Charlene Hunter-Galt, a journalist based in Johannesburg, joins us for today's underreported segment to take a look at South Africa's political dysfunction. And we're very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi.
Hello, Leonard, and hello to your listeners.
President Jacob Zuma has been criticized for lacking an overall economic strategy. Has he developed a clear economic policy to reduce South Africa's unemployment rate?
Well, I think there's a clear economic strategy that has emerged since I wrote a long piece in The New Yorker that appeared back in July. There's the Minister of Finance has presented what he calls a growth path, which is supposed to generate something like, 2.5 to 5 million jobs. But so everybody is sort of gotten behind that. You don't hear many dissenters. What you hear are a lot of questions about how this is actually going to be achieved. Because, as you said, I think the unemployment rate is even higher than 23%. I think it's more like 25. And in some of the townships, that is the places where black people predominate, there's 80 to 90% unemployment. And so even though there's discussion about producing, 5 million jobs, I think it is, by 2020, some of the details, the devil is in the details, and the details are lacking. I mean, they talk about 5 million jobs, but to get that, you need enormous growth, a growth of something like 7%. And right now, the growth is somewhere between 2 and 3%. So, you know, while everybody now, nobody's saying, oh, the government's all over the place, as they were saying last July, nobody has figured out exactly how they're going to generate these 5 million jobs.
When the African National Congress took power 15 years ago, didn't the poor people of South Africa expect their situation to improve? You're suggesting... Go ahead.
No, I would even quarrel, and you know, I admire you tremendously as a journalist, but I would take exception to the use of the term dysfunction, because in spite of what is amazing about this country is despite the things that you mentioned, rampant crime at the highest levels, we can talk about that in a moment, corruption at the highest levels, the country continues to function. You have demonstrations in the streets in some of the communities over service delivery, and those could grow, and that's probably part of the ticking time bomb here. But South Africa, in less than 5 weeks, is going to the polls in local elections. People are registering to vote. There's a constitution that recently overruled something that was huge in this country when they dismantled one of the elite crime-busting units just as Jacob Zuma was becoming president. And the Constitutional Court has just ruled that that was inappropriate. So, you know, while you have many, multiple challenges, right now you do have a functioning democracy.
Well, there are critics. Rian Malan, writing in book form, says of South Africa that it's almost impossible to explain the country's slow-motion catastrophe in a way that makes sense to foreigners. And he cites any number of scandals that in other countries would have brought down governments but just seem to be shrugged off. And then the next one comes along. And then there's, you know, the bribes and all of the corruption, the sorts of things that would not be tolerated in most democracies.
Well, Americans have forgiven a few high-level criminals. But anyway, aside from that, some have been convicted. The chief of police recently was found guilty of corruption. And while he hasn't gone to jail yet, at least there's a sentence there, and he's appealed it, which is why he isn't in jail. And I'm not, you know, saying by any means that there is rampant corruption at the highest levels, and even some of the ruling African National Party's own constituents within their broad church of membership are criticizing them, saying that this has become a predatory state. There's no question about that. What I'm saying is that I wouldn't say that the country is yet dysfunctional. When you talk about dysfunctional, that's where no justice is happening. Mm-hmm. And there is some justice still happening. It's slow. But the other thing that I think people outside of this country forget, this is a 20-year-old democracy, multiracial democracy, 20 years. Now, when you look around the world, including in America, 20 years into the democracy of theirs, where were you? And, you know, today we have instantaneous communication, so we know about all the bad things instantly. And the way we look at the way Americans in particular, but the West in general, looks at Africa is through what I've written in the past, the prism of the four Ds. So it's death, disease, disaster, and despair. And in the case of South Africa, it's corruption, crime, et cetera, et cetera. I don't excuse any of the stuff that's going on here that is so threatening to this young democracy. But I do say that at this point, I do not consider it dysfunctional.
Well, okay, but its neighbor, Zimbabwe, can be described as dysfunctional. And hasn't that added to some instability in South Africa? Because so many people, so many refugees are coming into South Africa to escape Robert Mugabe's that dysfunctional situation there?
No question. Now, that is where dysfunctional actually is totally accurate. It's the failed state, essentially. And it has has intruded into South Africa and created enormous problems for this country. I mean, you get various estimates of how many Zimbabweans are here in South Africa, 2 million, 3 million, who knows. And last year there was a wave of xenophobia, because the one thing that Robert Mugabe did when he came to power back in 1980 was he educated his people. And a lot of those people are under threat now because they're challenging the terrible reign of Robert Mugabe. And because they cannot function in a society where there's no free speech, they come into South Africa. Well, now, some of them come for economic reasons, others come for political reasons. And that has put a lot of strain on South Africa, to be sure. But it has not yet here reached the level of dysfunction.
But Zuma and his predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, have been acting as mediators in Zimbabwe, but they haven't really done much to change the situation there. Why?
No, it's very difficult. It's so funny because there was so much hope that there was some sense that maybe Mbeki was a little too close to Mugabe. I don't know. That remains to be seen. But certainly there wasn't a lot accomplished in that intervention. And so there was a lot of hope for the intervention of Zuma. Well, just two or three days ago, Zimbabwe criticized Zuma in the harshest way, saying that there was an editorial in their newspaper, which is really the government mouthpiece, saying that Zuma was erratic and disaster-prone, described him as a liability not only to South Africa but to the rest of the continent. And part of that, and who knows what provoked it, was because Zuma stepped back from one position and then voted in the UN Security Council in favor of imposing a no-fly zone in Libya. 2 days later, they backed down from this attack on Zuma. Now, why was that? You know, I have a number of people here who are journalists downstairs waiting for me to come back to dinner. And this has been one of the big debates at the table. Why did Mugabe back down? Because once he takes a position, he rarely ever backs down. So does that mean that there really is something that Zuma has in his, you know, pocket that might help advance this situation? None of us knows. But what we do know is at this point, neither President Zuma nor President Mbeki has been able to shake the foundations of that incredibly despotic rule of Robert Mugabe.
In the profile you wrote of Zuma last July in The New Yorker, you visited a settlement called Orange Farm. What was going on there?
Well, at the time I visited, like, you know, as in places all over the country, local people are demonstrating because this government, which promised so much because it's a black-led government representing a majority black country, that they have failed these people. They have not provided basic services like lights, water, electricity. I mean, I went into some places where people were living by sewers that I could hardly stand near because they were so revolting. One child even fell into a hole that was used as a toilet by the local people, and because it was so deep and filled with so much stuff, the child drowned. Well, when I'm not going to talk to you today, I phoned one of my contacts in Orange Farm, and I've been in periodic contact, and I said, what's happening out there? Has the government yet come and done anything to the conditions out there? And my contact out there said, nothing, nothing, nothing has happened. And that's another of the ticking time bombs in this country.
And I'm
not
sure
yet dysfunctional. But it could be, because all of these local people are without the basic services, and despite the fact that the government is a government that's basically primarily of their own color, they are not going to be so sympathetic if their inequality, as you and doing without continues.
Charlene, thank you so much for talking with us. Charlene Hunter-Galt. We've been talking about the situation in South Africa as part of today's underreported segment. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Leonard.
Go back to dinner.